Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books and Biography, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Krisa Pugh at Harvard University. Today, my guest is Dr. Paul Vanderveld, who is a biographer and researcher who's written extensively on the lives of scientist P.J. Veth and travel writer Jakob Hofner, about whom his biography will be focusing on today's conversation. In addition to biography, Dr. Vanderveld has written on a number of topics ranging from colonial and art history to articles on the province of Zealand and the Asia-Europe meeting. He served as a scientific researcher at the Institute for the History of the European Expansion and Reactions at Leiden University. And most recently, he was an editor-in-chief and head of communications at the International Institute for Asian Studies at Leiden University, a founder of the International Convention of Asia Scholars, and the executive director of the Institute for Comparative Political and Economic Institutions. Today, we'll be discussing Dr. Vanderveld's book, Life Under the Palms, The Sublime World of Anti-Colonialist Jakob Hofner, which was published by NUS Press Singapore in 2020. In the biography, he explores the life of Jakob Gottfried Hofner, who was one of the most popular European travel writers of the early 19th century. Dr. Vanderveld, it's a real pleasure to welcome you to the podcast. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
So just to start out, would you be able to just share a little bit about yourself and what is it that led you to write on Hofner's life?
Yes, I think, you rightly remarked that I worked at the Institute for History of European Expansion and Reaction in Leiden University for about 5 years, the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. And there there was a lot of study on colonialism and on imperialism. And one of the things which disturbed me a little bit is that the professors at that institute said that actually Dutch imperialism didn't exist. So in the sense of other imperialisms, and I thought, well, that is complete nonsense, and I also proved that it was nonsense. And one of the ways in which I did that in a more, let's say, elegant way was by having the books, the writings of Jakob Hofner republished in three volumes in a very serious academic series, and explaining a little bit that, let's say, a person at the end of the 18th century could be able to be so open to other cultures in comparisons to others, and also completely rejecting the colonial situation in India and in South Africa.
Was it the first undertaking, kind of serious undertaking of Hofner's life and his biography that was undertaken when you published this volume?
Yes, I mean, this writer was completely forgotten when I started working on him. It was a complete coincidence because I got into touch with an Indian businessman who was in textile business, and he wanted to make a movie, and he asked me to write something about what had been written about India in the Netherlands in the 17th and 18th century. So I also didn't know Hofner, so I ran into him. And then I saw the potential of a movie because one of his main works, Travels in a Palanquin, is about his love relationship with the Indian dancer Mamiya. So also the Indian text, the Indian textile man, he thought was a good idea. So a script was written, but then he rejected the script. So the film was never made. And I thought, this is a pity. So I started working on Hafner. First, I thought that he was a travel liar. So there were many travel liars at that time. And gradually, I started to find out that what he wrote, although it was, of course, to a certain degree romanticized, was based on actual persons living in India, mainly in India. So that's how it all started. And then the three volumes came out. It was an exhibition. And then only later on, like after 15 years, I thought, well, maybe now my Dutch biography should be translated into English. And as you might have, if you have read the book, you could see that he was not particularly person who liked the English a lot and the English way of colonizing. So,
right.
Yeah.
Great. I'm really curious to know a little bit more, if you could bring us into your process, mm-hmm. In terms of conducting the research, and also writing the book. I'd love to know just a little bit more about how you actually were able to do both of those things.
Yeah. Well, it was, you must imagine that I worked a part-time at the Institute, so I had time to do things in my spare time. And we have this, over in the Netherlands, there is this enormous archive of the Dutch United India Company, the VOC archives in The Hague. So I was able to track his records because he was in the service of the Dutch East India Company. So I could follow his travels and seen where he was at a certain point of time, on what ships. So gradually, the idea that he was a travel liar completely disappeared. Of course, I also did research in, for example, Ceylon, where there's also a VOC archive. And in the India office in London, where there is also material to be found on Hafner. And of course, this all took quite some time, because these archives are mostly written in 17th or 18th century Dutch, so they are not very accessible. And of course, as always, you have to be very careful with what is set in those in the archives of the VOC, because, needless to say, they were written from the perspective of the VOC, so you will never find very revolutionary things in there. One good example of that is that Hafner describes how a young slave, you don't say slave anymore, I'm convinced of that, but I go back to that time, who was in South Africa, who was burnt to death, was burnt on the stake. And this was actually described by Hafner, and this was not like really in the archive. There was a small note made of it, but Hafner gave a description of how they went about doing that. So, one has to be careful if one used these kind of archives, needless to say.
Yeah, I was really interested in that, because there is a point at which in the book you talk about, kind of being skeptical of some of the things that you read, in Hafner's own accounts. And even, this idea of, this is something that I'm unfamiliar with, but this idea of kind of false tales, or people, lying kind of about their travels and their excursions. And so I'm wondering, how did you square, or kind of how did you reconcile, the personal writings of Hafner versus the, kind of quote unquote official archive of the VOC? How did you, kind of reconcile the tension, if there was one, between the two?
Well, let's say the VOC is a kind of bookkeeper's institution, so they are quite factual. So all the things of ships arriving on a certain date, people who were there at a certain point of time, they are quite correct. But if you look at other aspects of life in a society, they can be completely falsified. I mean, so I didn't take them too seriously. So at the one hand, you have the tension of, well, that what you are reading, you must put question marks behind that all the time. But on the other hand, you must also accept that there are certain things which are, yeah, quite factual. Although, for example, in terms of figures on trade and stuff like that, you're never sure also because, or neither, because there was a lot of trade going on the side, which, yeah, which you cannot see back in the official bookkeepings of the VOC. And I made one. There was one short biography in the beginning of my research, which was dealing mainly with the factual cases. And then later on, we tried to find other sources of other writers as well, who had been in places where he was at the same time. So you come to a kind of reconciliation. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's, you know, there's a question of, you know, kind of fact and factual evidence, which you point to. And then there's also this question of power that you allude to as well. It's like, so even if you have, you know, theoretically, you know, kind of factual information, you know, from logbooks and whatnot, there's still the question of, well, whose perspective is being represented, you know, whose voices are being left out, whose voices are being included, whose voices are kind of dominating the narrative. And I think one of the brilliant things about this book is that you really show how Hefner tried to, you know, kind of breathe life into, you know, kind of the everyday common experiences of the people that he was encountering when he was traveling. And so with that said, I'm wondering if you have a favorite excerpt or passage from the book that you'd like to share.
Yes, I really have. But first of all, I think it's good if you say something about, let's say, the time in which he lived. I mean, because when he returned, he was very positive about Indian culture. He mainly stayed in India during his stay in Asia. So you must imagine he arrived there in India in a very small Dutch between brackets harbor town with very small buildings, and then he walked into the country, so to say, and then we went to Mahabalipuram, which is on the east coast of India, and there he saw these enormous buildings and constructions, and so he was completely overpowered with what he saw. And then coming back to the Netherlands, he tried to tell his story about the great Indian culture, so to say. But they just frankly did not believe him. And that's because they lived in a time when they still thought that the world was created in 7000 BC and that all writings which were not in the Holy Scriptures were corruptions. So the Vedas, for example, were a corruption of the Holy Scriptures, and it was high time that the Western missionaries brought back the real Vedas. So to give you an idea of how people are, the majority, 99.999%, thought at that point in time. So it was very difficult for him to, let's say, to talk about this. Yeah.
Great. That's really helpful background. So, do you want to share the passage?
And I want to, of course I want to share the passage. I mean, in general, I can remark that he was his descriptions are very lively. And he, for example, also introduces interviews in his five travel stories. So he really let people talk. So now, well, this place and the background, he was living in Sadraspatnam around 1781, 1782, which was a very multilingual, very multicultural surrounding, and in which, let's say, central authority was very far away. I mean, Calcutta was the main town, or the capital. And so he, so they felt, I mean, all people who were living there, working there, had a kind of very casual behavior. Okay, now this is a description of this Sadraspatnam when he, okay, it starts out as follows. A dozen young men are memorizing poems. So this plays in Sadraspatnam. Sitting beside them is a group of boys reciting the alphabet, and next to them, a group of 30 toddlers calling out the first letters of the alphabet. Others are saying their timetables out loud, and a couple of advanced students are reading Puranas in a lilting voice. One listens to the other, and in betwixt their chants, you can hear the soft feminine voices of a couple of young Devadasis or temple dancers. The pavement swarms with beginners in the art of writing. They are seated with crossed legs and practice writing characters in the sand, while shouting them out loud. In short, everybody is screaming and yelling. My morning stroll would always include a visit to the bazaar. Jugglers, soothsayers, basket makers, tattooists, and women selling colored glazed bangles and extremely tasty rice, pancakes, congregate here. The stalls are open for business. The merchants arrive with their touchstone, gold scales and bags full of cash and rupees. Word cash, by the way, is also an Indian word. They display their linen or other goods, while mendicants take up their usual positions near the temple devoted to the god Ganesh. A couple of naked fakirs move about, trying to draw people's attention. It is around 9 in the morning. Buyers and those who are just curious arrive. The market and the streets are bustling and thronging with people. Not before long, the whole street is filled with 1,000 voices. Mangoes, ripe mangoes, tamarind, yellow and ripe bananas, creamy milk. Who wants creamy milk? Buffalo milk, fresh and clarified butter. Pickled nuts, vegetables, areca and betel, ripe and fresh coconuts, fresh palm fruit. The screaming and yelling is beyond compare. The crying of the little children, the singing of the sannyasins with their clanging cymbals, the drums of the yogis, the hobo snake charmers, and much more of that ilk. The proud temple bull clears a way through these streets, teeming with people. He grabs a mouthful of vegetables at several stalls. The merchants not only let him be, but offer him their best selections. They try to lure him because everybody feels honored when he pays them a visit. Close. End of quote.
Wow, that's really incredible. And it's, I mean, you're really transported, you know, with that language. I mean, you can almost, you feel like you're there. You can, you know, hear the sounds and almost taste the taste. So that's really incredible. I'm really curious, I know that you've also spent quite a bit of time in the region in South Asia, and I'm really curious, you know, what came first for you? Did you read these travelogues and were you inspired by Hafner's writings? He's, you know, these very evocative tales to go and travel, or had you spent time in the region and then, you know, reading these travelogues kind of resonated with you and made you want to write about his life? Like, what was the kind of order of events there?
Well, the order of events is that I've been in Asia already on several occasions, and this just came along when I was working at this Institute for Colonial History, and I thought this would like really give another voice to the regular, mostly very dull ship journals and whatever there was produced or articles which were written. So it only, reinforced my previous ideas about the counter voice in the 18th century. And that's what I followed. And then, of course, I started working on this, which I explained earlier. I started working on the re-edition of his travel writings.
Yeah, that's great. So it was kind of an iterative process there. So I'm curious if you encountered, as you were doing the research or as you were, in the process of writing this book, were you surprised by anything that you found either in the archive or as you were, kind of going through the materials and working through his life? Is there anything that you found that was particularly striking or surprising that you didn't expect?
First of all, I said that before. At first I thought that he just had made up this whole story, but then I gradually started to find out that he really did the things he said he'd done. He really met the people whom he describes in his works, and he really was on ships which went through stormy periods. So and if you ask if there is a very special thing, it was more his endeavor to bring across the idea of other cultures being at least at the same level of the Western culture, not to say on a higher level than the Western culture, and that really strike me.
Do you feel like that's is that an enduring quality of, is that something that you feel like is a lesson that we can, in terms of extracting, in this moment of kind of, decolonization, there's a lot of conversation about decolonization, about anti-colonial resistance, not just across the global South, but I think, more globally, I'm curious if you feel like there are lessons that we can apply from Hafner's life and the way that he lived and the way that he engaged in this region to our practices today.
Yeah, I certainly believe that. I mean, although I do not want to become someone who is missionary for Hafner's works, but it's certainly a good read to see how a person tried to get into almost he wanted to become Indian among Indians. He also found out, of course, that's not possible because you have been educated or in your home country, so to say, and then you try to move to another place. It's very difficult to assimilate. But he tried that, and he did that to a high degree, I think, because he was one of the first persons, anyway, in the Netherlands or in the West, who learned Tamil and Hindi, and he could do all kinds of things with poetry and stuff. And he came back super enthusiastic about India, but nobody was interested in him, except for, and this is also something which must be remarked, he came into contact with Schlegel, the famous German philosopher of Romanticism and also of Indian studies in Germany. And I think at least that was the one person he convinced of the fact that the culture of India or the Indian culture was at a higher level than Western culture. So.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like he did Hafner, you mentioned that he was the first Dutch traveler to really spend time in the region and to learn to speak Tamil and Hindi. Do you feel like he inspired then, was there kind of a generation of people that came after him that were, inspired to also do this kind of work and to travel in this way? Or did it take some time? Because you said that you were, it seemed like from what you'd said earlier that he was a fairly obscure figure, at least in when you started writing about him. And so
he's still not very famous, but anyway, he's now in the canon of Dutch literature. So books have been sold. So people certainly in certain circles know who Hafner is and what he's been doing. But he has the disadvantage that there's another author in the Netherlands who's called Multatuli, of whom is always said that he was a big anti-colonialist, while in fact he was supporting the imperial system. And so there is this shadow of Multatulius hanging over him. And it's very difficult, I don't know whether you have experience with it, to get somebody back to life, in a sense, if he has been completely forgotten. So that's what I ran into. And I hope with his translation into English that he will find a wider audience.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we keep, you know, kind of throwing around this term anti-colonialism. And I'm wondering if we could just explore that a little bit. So, you know, what do you feel like, well, first of all, is this a term, you know, would Hafner himself have, you know, would he self-identify as an anti-colonialist, or is that something that, you know, as a contemporary label, we're able to apply to him, you know, kind of retroactively? And what do you feel like kind of anti-colonialism meant for Hafner during his life? What did it actually mean?
Well, it was primarily directed against missionaries and missionary societies, which you see to this very day. I lived myself in Taiwan, and there were Mormon preachers who were trying to convert the Chinese population, so to say. And he completely ridiculized that because he said, well, the Indians have their own religion and they're quite happy with it. And then he indeed ridiculized all kinds of priests, so Roman Catholic priests who were whipping themselves, and everybody was laughing. At least the local population was laughing about this crazy guy. And then he transposes that back to, let's say, the Netherlands, where people were all giving money to proselytize in India, and he completely ridiculized that. And this biblical society, or the society for the missionaries, they did, after he published his first, let's say, global anti-missionary book in 1807, he was completely became a complete outcast in society, because that was not acceptable. But then they put a committee into place to do research into what he had said, and then long time after he had died. They come to the conclusion that he was right and that they should listen to what he had to say, so that missionaries should be better educated and so forth. But in fact, he was completely against these kind of activities.
Right. And what do you feel like, would you say that this kind of, resistance to, imperial domination, to, the culture of, of missionaries, would you say that that was his most significant legacy, or are there other aspects of his life that you can point to that have been, just as influential as part of his legacy?
Well, apart from that, his style of writing was, of course, very revolutionary for that point of time, because most of the people their style of writing was very dull, and so you could not form an idea of how real life was in India at that point in time. And I think his main legacy is in his anti-colonial stance, in which he stands in a tradition going down to Bishop de las Casas and stuff like that, or persons like that. And people still don't, anyway, in the Netherlands, still don't see that he was like a true anti-colonialist, but at the same time also a person who was very open to other cultures. And this is a little bit naughty saying, but for example, if he would be alive nowadays, he would also not be in favor of development aid. And I don't mean development aid when there is a real crisis in food supplies or whatever, but the way development aid is played out in the world. So that's I don't know what you think about that. But,
I mean, absolutely. I think there have been a lot of, you know, comparisons to, you know, of international development aid to the kind of, you know, missionary, industrial complex, if you will. So I can absolutely see parallels between Hafner's critique of missionaries and his day and, a lot of the, and just in terms of like the dependency that's created, and also just the, you know, this idea of kind of undermining the self-sufficiency of nations. So, yeah. And like you said, this idea of trying to replace one religion, a dominant religion, with indigenous cultures and religions, it's like, these spaces, these cultures, these societies, have their kind of own autonomous, ways of life and being. And, to your point, about development aid and also, religious outreach, that's oftentimes threatened, when a dominant culture or dominant, framework of development comes in. So I can absolutely see those parallels. Going back to something that you just said about Hafner's style of writing, one of the things that I really loved about your book is that you would cite entire passages of his writing to really bring us into, how he was thinking, and then the way that he would translate, those thoughts and those experiences that he was having on the page. And so I'm really curious about, do you know anything about Hafner's background in terms of how did he learn to write? Did he have formal training in writing, or is this something that he just kind of developed organically as he was traveling?
Well, it's clear that he made notes during his stay in India, although those were never found. So it's not sure that he really made notes, but otherwise he must have had a very, very vivid memory about everything which happened in his life. So I think that that was based on note. But in the beginning, although he rejected colonialism, he had been trading the last 2 years of his stay in India. So when he came back, he had some money, and he thought, well, maybe I could live from this. But then he invested them in French French stocks, so to say, state stocks, and that went that was completely worthless in a couple of years. So he had to start working, and he also had a family to keep up. So because he married when he came back in Amsterdam. So at first he was a kind of pipe vendor in Amsterdam. And then he tried to come into contact with all kinds of learned societies in the Netherlands, for example, the Dutch Learned Society in Haarlem. And he tried to sell his written works to them, but that he was not very successful at that. So he started to write. He came into contact with the publisher, and you can see in the beginning, there are still a couple of handwritings left over from him in the archives. And there you see that in the beginning, it was not yet very well developed, but very soon he got like a good and nice style of writing, which resounded in society, because he became a very, very famous writer at the time, around the time he was dying, so to say. But nevertheless, also his works were translated in several other European languages. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's easy to see, and understand why he's become such a famous writer in that regard. I mean, it's really almost poetic, the way that he writes. Do you feel like, are there any aspects of Hafner's life that, that have not been explored either in your, not just in this book, in the biography, but in the other volumes on Hafner's life that you've written, you and your co-author have written? Are there any aspects of his life that have not been explored that you feel like, there's room to examine and to develop more introspection about his life?
Yeah, well, that's a question which, after 25 years of research into Hafner, is a little bit difficult for me to answer. But I mean, his, for example, his connection with the Romantic movement, so with this German philosopher Schlegel, it might still be a possibility to do more research about. But for the rest, I mean, there always, you know, something might pop up, like, you know, that his handwritings show, come on a come for sale at a certain point of time, but that's not to be expected, I think, you know. So there is also one other aspect which I ran into was the big Caribbean population in London at the time, which still needs a lot of research, I think. So some time ago there was research done in the southern part of England, and there it seems that 20% had genetic material from the Caribbean, and there was a very lively Caribbean culture in London in the 18th century. So, but that is not directly related to Hafner as such, but more that let's say the influence of people from the Caribbean, from Africa, has always been much bigger than we think. Mm-hmm. But because there was one figure in Hafner as such, whom he describes, and he was a guy from the Caribbean, and he was seemingly extremely intelligent, and also in the favor of one high countess in England. And he was, Hafner gives a description of him while he was in a jail in Calcutta. It was, and where he still, yeah, he still was very much involved in Indian society. So this, it gives this idea of people who move around the earth without we know that they have moved around the earth. So it's a kind of coincidence that Hafner gives a description of this guy who would otherwise be completely forgotten. But now, fortunately, I've sent this material to someone in London who is studying this. So maybe in the future there will be a spin-off from our research into Hafner.
Yeah, I mean, it just seems like there's so much material there. You also sent me two articles that you've been working on. The first is Jacob Hafner's treatise on the disastrous effects of missionary activities worldwide. And then the second is The World According to Jacob Hafner, travel writer and anti-colonialist. I'm wondering if you could just give the listeners a preview of what is in both of these articles, and have they already been published, or are they still in process?
Yeah. Well, as you have seen, I have published quite some books, and I'm now working, or it's now at the publishers. I'm working on a book called The Asian Studies Parade, which is based, the title is based on a parade which we held in Leiden in 2019. During the 11th edition of the International Convention of Asia Scholars, of which I was co-founder and longtime secretary, which for me was a kind of reflection of how Asian studies could fit in a larger context of society. So all these people from all parts of the world, they walked through the city of Leiden and also came into contact with the rest of the population, so to say. So no longer did they move in an ivory tower, but were in the streets of Leiden for a certain point of time. So I came back to this. To these articles in my book. So there will be about 30 chapters in that book. And this will reflect what I have been doing in the past and also what I have been doing in respect to my biographical research. also of P.J. Vet and Jacob Hafner. And in those two articles, we have been talking about this before. The one is on his treatise against missionaries and missionary societies, which is, let's say, the first global essay on the negative effects of missionary work. So he not only talks about India, but also about Hawaii and on South America, of course, and he puts it in a historical perspective. The other article is more or less on the way Hafner saw the world, and there was a world which was quite multicultural, I must say, and also multilingual. So he, in those articles, I explained that more in detail.
That's great. I'm very much looking forward to those being published and hope that folks will be able to check them out. So just a final question for you, beyond these two articles, I'm really curious what other projects you're working on right now. I know that you're still traveling quite a bit and you have multiple interests beyond Hafner. And so I'm wondering if you could just share any projects that you're excited about that you're currently working on or things that might be in the pipeline.
So as you know, I am retired. So I'm still planning on doing things, but maybe also other things. As you also remarked, I have been very busy in my native province, and I might take a look at my native village because I have written a monograph on a painter from that village as well, who had worked in Indonesia in the beginning of the 20th century. So that's certainly a thing I will continue to do. And in my book, you will also find quite a few articles on the Asia-Europe meeting process, which started in 1996. And this was a kind of way of bringing Europe and Asia back together in a post-colonial setting. This went all very well until a certain point of time, to 2011, when Xi Jinping came to power and more or less halted that process. So I've been really living in a time which was really into globalization of the world and also on bringing cultures together. And now you see this trend going the other way, which to my regret, I must say.
Right, absolutely. Well, that's really important work. And that's just looking forward to seeing, what comes of that. So thank you. This has been a really, really wonderful conversation, Paul.
I hope so.
And I wish you, it's been really great. And just wishing you all the best in your retirement. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Krissa.
So this has been a conversation with Dr. Paul Vandervelt about his book, Life Under the Palms, The Sublime World of the Anti-Colonialist Jacob Hafner. Again, I'm Krissa Pugh of Harvard University, and this has been an episode of New Books in Biography, a channel on the New Books Network. Thank you for listening.